Welcome to this week's installment of Cultural Conversations. You can leave questions and comments at our Facebook page at facebook.com/culturalconversations.
One of the many issues addressed at the recent Rio 20 United Nations Conference on Sustainable Development was food security. Concerns over rapidly degrading soils, freshwater supplies, ocean and forest habitats, and coinciding decreased biodiversity led to a UN think tank for discovering solutions targeting food security issues. Several things are included under the umbrella of food security, such as food availability, access, utilization, and stability issues. But food security also includes individual rights to nutritious foods that meet dietary needs and food preferences of individuals and communities. Most of you have probably never thought of the concept of food equity before. I've known many who were dismayed over the fact homeless individuals turned away food offerings only to tell the food donor they didn't care for it. Should hunger trump food preferences? If someone were to knowingly offer you fried grasshoppers as a protein snack or smoked camel for dinner, would you be so quick to eat either? The bottom line is that we all have the right to food preferences, regardless of our circumstances. What about immigrant populations such as the Burmese political refugees or African political asylees in the Fort Wayne area? They've been invited or offered asylum by the federal government, but in no way does this require them to give up their foodways. They have the right to continue eating the only foods they know how to prepare and digest. So how do they feed themselves when they arrive here? To talk about food equity, I'm here with Holly Shaley, director of the Catherine Casper Place, and vegan consultant Colleen Towner.
First, I want to ask you what food equity means to you both, whoever wants to begin.
I think food equity means that people have the right to decide what they want to eat and what they don't want to eat, more importantly.
I agree with Colleen. I think there's a tendency for folks to think that food equity means food equality, so everybody should get a fair share of whatever it is, when in fact it is about unique circumstances and personal preferences, whether that's, you know, allergies or cultural or
religious beliefs.
Right.
Now, Holly, can you describe what the Catherine Casper Place does in regard to food equity issues?
Sure. We're a refugee and immigrant and political asylee serving agency, and one of our most successful programs is called the Fresh Food Initiative, and we work with our clients to grow culturally appropriate food locally within walking distance for the most part of their homes. And what we're finding is that, of course, when they come over here, they don't have money, they don't have jobs, they don't have a grasp of the language, so it's incredibly hard for them to navigate even just a general grocery store and try to find things that work for their nutritional needs and their religious or traditional circumstances. So we work very closely with all of our clients to make sure that they have access to and the ability to grow their own foods.
And how different are the needs between the different immigrant populations you're serving? Does it require you to work in very different capacities to serve each of those cultural needs?
Actually, no. Farming is thousands of years old. Everybody does pretty much the same thing. Most of our refugees have farmed longer than I've been alive, so they're absolute experts at it. The differences are mainly between the types of foods they grow. There are times when some of the things that they're used to growing are not going to happen in the soils here in Indiana. But for the most part, it's just a difference in the seed that you're putting in the ground and what produces from them.
And where are these gardens in the Fort Wayne area?
We have some gardens adjacent to Autumn Woods Apartments. Mm-hmm. We have a garden up in the north part of the city. We have folks who are growing in containers that we supplied last year. And this year, as part of our new summer project, we will have about 24 wheelbarrows that are serving as world food gardens around the community.
Can you describe that wheelbarrow project?
Yeah, that's my favorite project to date. It's called the World on Wheels or WOW Garden Project, and we are partnering with sponsors, local artists, and cultural liaisons from different ethnicities living in Fort Wayne to showcase those ethnicities and the types of food they eat and how easy it is to grow, not just easy in a container, so there's not really the excuse of I don't have enough yard, but how easy it is to supply food for your family within that small container. And the thing that spurred this project is that we're hoping this public market idea that lots of strong voices have been talking about for a couple of years now comes to fruition in the next couple of years. And when that happens, most of the vendors are going to be these refugee, immigrant, local gardeners and farmers, and will want to be familiar with their foods, will want to know what it is we're purchasing as educated consumers. So we're trying to help people so that there's not a stumbling block when we hit that milestone of having
help create a market for what they're growing and help them create sustainable businesses.
Yes.
And what's the vision for that market you said that's been in the works for the last 2 years?
Well, the vision is that we will have a year-round public market that is primarily run and supported by local farmers.
In a centralized location, instead of having, you know, the North Side Market open from 4 to 8 and then Bar Street Market open on Saturday mornings, it brings all the farmers together in one location. Because farmers should be farming and growing, not worrying about selling and driving all over town to the little farmers markets at various times and trying to sell their crops out of the back of a truck is very difficult. So hopefully it will create a sustainable farming marketplace where consumers and farmers come together.
Will this be at a central location to cut down on the transportation to and from vendor
yes,
sites?
Yes, we're both on the working committee to implement this, and I don't believe that they've chosen a specific location. There are several in the works of how that would work and phases of development, you know, what goes in first, and that sort of thing. So yeah, it would be centrally located, hopefully in the downtown area, in a good access in and out.
It'd be a nice way to just continuously redevelop the downtown area, to rehabilitate the downtown area. It'd be a wonderful way to do that. Something I've found in my own work is this notion of food deserts, that a lot of our urban areas are food deserts. You know, children don't realize food is actually grown, or as I tell my students, create in a laboratory. but they don't realize where food comes from. And, you know, in a cityscape, you don't see evidence. Now, this is slowly changing, and I've been encouraged in driving around the Fort Wayne area seeing what looks like city gardens. It's nice to see that change. But most people, you know, you don't see that in downtown Fort Wayne. Would you, Colleen, describe it as a food desert?
I definitely think we have food deserts. When I was working with Green Bean Delivery as their market consultant for Fort Wayne, I learned a lot about what people don't have access to. And it's very easy as a suburban mother to say, well, you should eat more vegetables. If you live in a location where you can only go to the market pantry or whatever, and it's basically gas station food, Cinnabons that might be 3 years old, in a plastic package, and that's the cheapest thing you can buy for your family, it most certainly is a food desert. I believe personally that food creates health, and I think that the food deserts are very closely related and interlinked with the health problems that we're seeing in children, the diabetes and even the ADDs and the things that are creating learning disabilities, heart disease, all of these things. You know, they have access to cigarettes and Cinnabons, but there's not a fresh pepper, and they wouldn't know what to do with it if they had it. And that is another thing that goes along with food equity, is not only having access to it, but then understanding what to do with it.
The education component.
Exactly. Yeah. How do you take five different vegetables and create a meal out of it, as opposed to opening a box of pretzels and, you know, dipping it in cream cheese and calling that dinner?
Right. So. Any thoughts on that, Holly? Do you agree that we live
in a food desert.
Yeah, in a food desert.
Well, up until several months ago, I would absolutely agree with that, although I was at a program wherein LaDonna Redmond was speaking, and she's a great, she's just a really good advocate for food justice and food equity, and she was talking about how the term food desert is kind of not an accurate portrayal, because a desert in and of itself is a sustainable ecosystem, and we're talking about something that's not going to be sustainable. These folks aren't going to be able to live healthily or live very long on pork rinds and, you know, beef jerky and not a single fresh item around them.
Are there other agencies in town, like the Catherine Casper Place, that are addressing food equity issues as far as serving immigrant populations like you're doing here?
I don't know of others that serve immigrant populations. I'm sure you do, but I do know that our food banks are working very hard to no longer just provide the old expired generic processed macaroni and cheese to their customers. I know the Community Harvest Food Bank has the Farm Wagon program, and I know when I worked with Green Bean Delivery, partnered with NPR, we made donations during their fund drive week so that every donation triggered fresh produce. And I know that Jane Avery at Community Harvest is very much aware that not only do their clients need anything, but they need good food and they need fresh food. And so they've got the Farm Wagon program that delivers. And that's not really, that doesn't have anything to do with different ethnicities. It's just fresh potatoes and fresh green beans and fresh fruits, and they deliver that. So it's not just, you know, when we all clean out our pantries and feel like we're doing the world a favor by, you know, donating our old canned beets that nobody ate. Yes, that is something good, but we all need to do more to make sure that the people who need it most, the unhealthy, the poor, the young in our schools, the inner city people that don't have access to the large grocery stores with huge produce departments, those people deserve to eat good food, and it benefits society as a whole. Because when you feed people food that makes them sick, and then you have to pay for health care, as we're all looking at the health care bill, it's really a win-win situation. It's kind of like here in the United States, we educate everyone because we understand as a society, we don't want poor, you know, slums of people who are uneducated, you know, and unaware. Basically, we see the benefit and the value of mandating education, because it improves society. If we mandate and raise the bar on the food that we give everyone, it's also going to have the benefit of decreasing healthcare costs across the board.
Now, you mentioned the schools, and I've been a longtime advocate of creating healthier food options in schools. Is there a growing movement here for that in the Fort Wayne area?
I'm trying. I have a Facebook page called Fort Wayne School Lunches, and I think we're up to maybe 50 likes. I'm on the wellness committee, which obviously that's not really going to do much, but I'm on the wellness committee with Southwest Allen, and we're actively looking at low-hanging fruit, you know, changes that we can make immediately that don't cost any money, long-term goals. But it's a very slow process because people are very resistant to change, especially when that change might cost a little bit of money. And feeding kids, you know, the USDA buys subsidized products, and then subsequently our children are being given dog food grade meat at school because it's cheapest. And I know the gal that is responsible for planning the meals at Southwest Allen, and she works so hard, and she's expected to give our children nutritious lunches on less than $2 a day. And, you know, it's very difficult to do that. And so until we see as a society the benefit of investing in food, just like we invest in healthcare.
I think there's a little trick to how we make change within the schools or with regard to ethnic vendors at a public market and getting people to kind of try it. And that piece is kind of goes around healthy social interactions. If it's perceived that when I go to school and have lunch with my daughter that, you know, I am there having a good time. I'm bonding with my kid and I'm, you know, sitting down at the table and eating out of one of those retro trays that sometimes is fun to do. But I also, when I do that, I notice that she does have the first choices on that line are usually raw carrots and fresh fruit. And so it's changing a little bit at a time. And for me, that kind of interaction with the kids and the school cafeteria folks makes it easier and more palatable, if you will, for me to try to make change at the school. I don't feel like, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to fight City Hall, and there are probably, you know, government regulations about food that goes into school. But I'm kind of coming in from the side door, and I'm making friends and having discussion. I think that's what Colleen does too. We kind of have these local level discussions that aren't filibusters, and they're not angry, and they're just talking about, you know, everybody's perspective. And I think it's on some levels it's become easier to address school food, and then maybe on other levels it still seems like it's slow going.
I'm hoping more than anything that we're reaching a tipping point. More and more people are realizing that what they eat creates their health. And so I think we're reaching a level of awareness that hopefully will begin kind of like a wildfire, and a good one, to take off and just get people excited to not only demand better, but expect better for everyone.
As a vegan, Colleen, what have been your experiences with food equity in the society that we live in?
Well, the first words out of my mouth anywhere is always, I'm sorry, because my food choices inherently inconvenience everyone around me. So that is a difficult thing. I believe personally in the way I eat. I don't want to eat meat. But because my lifestyle is not a doctor's prescription, I am not gluten intolerant. I do not have celiac disease. It's very much more difficult to get people to understand why I have a right to feel, you know, I have a right to make food choices just like they do. And because I'm out of the majority, I'm usually, you know, stuck eating with very little choices. It's the longer I go as a vegan, the more I'm surprised when I go to a huge banquet, let's say American Heart Association fundraiser, that as a vegan, there's nothing there for me to eat. We're here to support heart disease, and we've got prime rib and sour cream on the, you know, mashed potatoes and cheese all over everything, and I'm lucky to get a raw carrot. And to me, that's not really right or fair, but, you know, that didn't come out right. In the end, it's very difficult for me to eat anywhere except for my own home. And I will tell you that if I get a product, if I consume something that has something I don't believe in, it's not going to kill me. I sat with a mother and son in Paris who are Muslim, and they live in San Francisco and believe very strongly that you don't eat meat. And to go to public events and not understand what's in the food, and then to consume something that has meat, for them is very, very painful to listen to that story of how they discovered there was meat in it. And I don't know a lot about that religion, but, you know, I can get over it a lot faster than they can. And then the same goes for people with celiac. And having traveled abroad where I don't speak the language gave me a whole new understanding for people that do have special foods, because it's very difficult to find out what's in something when you can't speak the language. So, you know, I'm at a restaurant in Italy. I don't speak Italian. How do I ask, is there egg in this pasta? Is there meat in this sauce? Is there cheese in this pesto? So, you know, immigrant populations that come in and aren't traveling on, you know, a nice vacation fund, how do they function in our society to make sure that they have access to foods and understand what they're eating?
Well, you say it's difficult when you're in another country and don't know the language to find out what you're eating. I think it can be as difficult to be here in the United States in a restaurant that you know and to find out what you're eating. You know, I've been with you out to eat. I've been with other folks in my family and other people who have different preferences, and sometimes we'll ask, you know, is this cooked with butter or how is this cooked? And, you know, it's not uncommon to have somebody say, oh, no, I don't think it has butter in it, kind of off the cuff, which is, it may be for that person not a big deal, but I think with respect to just personal preference, I don't think you have to be a Muslim who feels truly, this young man, I believe he said he felt like his soul died when he found out what he ate. That's, to me, horrific. I don't think you have to reach that level of pain in order to have your needs met. And when I'm with Colleen, I find it an adventure because I've been willing to go along and eat whatever people put on my plate. You know, there was a time back in the 80s or something when we were, you know, really actively saying no margarine, please, and thinking we were changing the world by our no margarine. And now I find that when she orders or she asks what's in the flatbread pizza and I'm hearing what's in the flatbread pizza, I can still choose to eat it, but I feel a little wiser, and I appreciate that.
There's a lot of empowerment with education.
Right.
With that.
Right. And you're talking to folks in this room. We are lucky to be as educated as we are. When my 8-year-old doesn't have a choice, like she doesn't have at school, you know, I've been telling her since kindergarten, since she started going to school where they provide lunch, here are the choices you can make. And if you don't see those options, default to yogurt or peanut butter. Now, either one of those could be a problem as well if she had lactose intolerance or a peanut allergy or just didn't care for either one of those things. But she has very little choice in what she's eating, and it's no wonder our kids are having trouble with not just obesity and inactivity, but there's starting to be a lot of correlation research around diabetes and attention deficit issues and allergies and things like that around, you know, it's coming to be recognized that those have strong food correlation.
Because more and more of our food is made of chemicals, not real food. Shelf life comes into play, preservatives, color. It makes me laugh when I see Go-Gurts that are neon orange being sold as a health food. There was a study done recently that showed that children fed an organic diet, after 1 week, the pesticide levels that could be detected in their blood fell to zero. I'm also a big proponent of organic and sustainably grown foods, and that's where I hope the tipping point of awareness comes in, when people understand that maybe you should ask what's in that and maybe you should care, because what you're eating is creating the body that you get to live in the rest of your life, however long or short that may be. And our children are being fed, you know, through the schools and via our restaurants and things like that, foods that have pesticides, growth hormones and antibiotics and all of these things. When people begin to simply connect those two dots, I think the expectation and the demand, you know, in Europe, most GMOs, there's only two crops that are legal in Europe. So Kellogg's in Europe provides cereal that is grown without GMO seeds. If they can do that for them and Americans begin to demand it, we can have that here as well and create more food equity. The first step, I think, as Holly said, is awareness. People have to understand that there is a choice and that they should ask what's in it.
Thank you for listening to Cultural Conversations, edited by Sarah DeLia and Blake Lau. Join me every Thursday for a new installment of the podcast at nipr.fm to learn more about this beautiful human mosaic. You can leave questions and comments at our Facebook page at facebook.com/culturalconversations.